majority of states, a bright line test essentially for punitive damages.
Okay, I think I understand.
It will have some language for you.
Yeah, all right, fine. Now, let me ask you this, since you're talking about products liability cases. You're aware, of course, that there are some product liability cases where punitive damages are asked for and are awarded by jurors because manufacturers, in the face of evidence of the potential harm and where we do, in fact, know that manufacturers have done outrageous things. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are those cases.
Yes, indeed.
You're not suggesting that we abolish the punitive damages across the board in all product liability cases, are you?
I think a result that the PMA would be in support of. That is not what I'm talking about now, though. What I'm talking about is when it has gone through a governmental approval process and when there's no evidence of either false statements or withheld information, that ought to be a bar.
I'm kind of taking advantage of your connection with the products liability field to find out whether you feel there are any of these product liability cases that we know about where there has been a willful misconduct by the manufacturer, whether you would favor the idea that in no event could punitive damage
be awarded. Well, the proposal that I'm talking about would not have that effect.
Yeah, I understand that. I'm asking you about what you think on this proposal that we've got.
Well, you know, as I said, I think that my client's position is that they're in favor of the flat ban on punitive damages. I think that if this committee and the legislature in its judgment decides that that's not a good idea, there are narrower approaches that can be taken.
Your proposal, it seems to me what your proposal will do is say, look, we acted in good faith and the government itself approved
precisely
the product, and so therefore we don't really fit within the definition of willful and wanton conduct
precisely
for which punitive damages should lie.
But it gives a bright line test to that so that there's a you know, frankly, it's a way of having that decision made at the summary judgment stage rather than subsequently down the road.
That's already the law, but it would move up the ability to get rid of the case in
precisely
court.
And I think and advance the cause of litigation delay if that's a factor in this deliberation.
Any questions by committee members, Mr. Gardner? Thank you very much.
Thank you. We'll have some language for you and appreciate your
attention. All right. Let's see now. Okay. Let's take a look at Section 6. Do we have any witnesses on Section 6? That's the okay. You are going to be a witness today, huh?
Oh yes. I just said on punitive damages I was not testifying.
Right.
They're listed under all of the others, some of which I will testify on, some of which
right.
I will not. For the record, my name is Kip Lombard. I represent SEALS, the Citizens Initiative for Equity in the Legal System. With regards to the provisions of Section 6, perhaps my first statement to you might shock you, but I would say that insofar as Section 6 goes, we support it. However, I would make the general statement at this point that I'm not sure that this goes and don't feel that it goes far enough to address the whole question of frivolous litigation. I would simply like to say that we do have been working with a proposal with regards to the possible award of attorney fees as well as other costs, which I gather in talking with committee staff, you're looking to about the 5th of February for the presentation of amendments. Is that correct?
I don't know.
All right. Well, I gather in your scheduling that we're looking approximately at that date for the presentation of additional amendments or what have you to the bill. I would also add that the other day when the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association was here and was discussing the possible enactment of Federal Rule 11, that I gather you have a proposed amendment in Senate Bill 325 in which it is being proposed that ORS 20.105 be amended, and that that issue may be brought up at that time. Now, so I guess I say at this point, in terms of our testimony on Section 6, I'd say fine. We support that. As to when you wish to address the further issue and further comments on addressing frivolous litigation, I don't know if you want to hold that until you look at the procedural changes proposed under Senate Bill 325, or just how you wish to address that, how and when.
Well, we'll just stick to what we got now in Section 6.
Okay, that's what I kind of assumed that that's what you wanted to do. And that's really all I came prepared to say today.
Any question of Mr. Lombard? All right, thanks. Okay. Section 7, are you going to be on that one, too?
On that one also,
all yes. All right, go ahead.
I've reviewed the provisions of Section 7. I think I would say this, you know, being mindful of the charge that you gave to us last week during the introductory comments and the question that, or the charge, I guess, that we provide proof of cause and effect, that is that the proposed change will lead to a reduction in premiums and or an increase in availability. I think it's been emphasized several times, no one change will lead to these results, and I would like to emphasize I don't think that any one change or even group of changes will lead to immediate results. In that light, I'm not sure that Section 7 is going to lead to that kind of result either, but I think it is a policy issue that we wish to address. Obviously, the interim committee wished to address, and I think is a good policy.
Senator Wires,
yes, question. Senator Wires.
After the changes passed in Washington, somebody in the insurance commissioner came out, or somebody came out and said that the rates didn't seem to be dropping right away. And then a man named Basil Badley or something like that, I read about this in the paper, said, we never told the Washington legislature while they were considering these changes that they would lower rates. And that's why I want to interrupt you, because I think I just heard you said that this particular change, nor no other particular change you can point to, nor possibly any combination of changes would reduce rates. Wasn't it something like that?
I said to an immediate reduction. There is no quick fix as such to an immediate reduction of rates.
Do you have any single or combination of changes that you are willing to testify to now on the record that are going to definitely bring about a lowering of rates?
I think our position on the package of things that we will be talking about, which in part, of course, is the package contained in your bill, that they will lead to a stabilization of rates, even possibly a reduction of rates, and will lead to an increase in availability of insurance. And I think that we can...
As you know, being a lawyer, the word possibility is one that's lightly taken in the law. It's one that leads to things being not allowed to go to the jury in some cases if you don't use the word at least probably. So it possibly would lower rates. Is that what you're saying?
I said that, yes, that certain changes may possibly in the longer run lead to even a lowering of rates.
Well, I don't want to hold you up anymore now, but as we go along, I want to get a pretty clear fix so there aren't, when people ask later, we'll know what the record was.
Well, I know now that the chairman asked earlier, and I don't know whether we will have a perhaps sort of a wrap-up opportunity at the end of the consideration of these measures or what to talk about the experiences in the other states. But I, at some point, we would like the opportunity to review the changes made in other states and explain from our understanding, our viewpoint, what those changes have led to. It's a little difficult to go through a bill like this section by section, of course, and sit here and tell you that, well, in Illinois, a provision like Section 7 led to a reduction in rates of X number of dollars within 6 months or something like that. You know we can't provide that kind of testimony. But I do think that we can, and when the appropriate time comes, we will present where we feel the changes, groups of changes, have had an effect.
Okay.
Specifically addressing Section 7.
Before
yes,
you start,
Mr.
Let me just interject.
Yes, Senator.
I should probably have said this at the beginning, but I want the committee members to know that at my request, the entire Chapter 752 has been placed in your bill folder, and that's the chapter that was supposed to have taken care of the
medical malpractice
problem of 1975. And that was the proposal at that time of the OMA, and that was the legislature's response, and it's still on the books. So I want the committee members to take the time and be familiar with that chapter. And the other thing, in the folder, council has indexed these three bills, 323, 24, and 25, by subject matter, and that's the way the hearings are being scheduled, so that you'll always want to have this index before you, so when the agenda shows that we're going to be discussing sections 8 and 9, you can, or you can look at the index and tell where each particular subject is found in the bill. I think it might be very helpful to the committee to have that index at your fingertips. I guess that's all I need to say in terms of kind of housekeeping. Go ahead.
Senator, just a question I have then in terms of Chapter 752 and the medical malpractice. I gather by your comments that at some point you'd like some testimony as to why or why not that had an effect or what effect it had. Is it your intention?
Because it's never been implemented.
Right.
I mean, what I'd like to find out is, you know, I think that all the members of this committee, and maybe I should just speak for myself, if there is some solution out there, I'd like to hear it. You know, what I'm afraid of is that there is such a mindset on the part of the members of this coalition on how this package ought to come through the legislature that no one's willing to talk about any alternatives. And 752 apparently wasn't the answer for some reason, and this is no time to go into why that is. It'll come up at some point in time. But I mean, I think that there are those here that are in the legislature that are working on this problem that are saying, well, now, if you could come up with an idea 12 years ago, there's got to be another idea out there. Is there something we can do to fix up Chapter 752? And I'm saying this for everybody's benefit, because I hope that as we go through these hearings that it's not going to be a situation where no one's going to come down from this position and no one's going to move from this position, because if we're going to get this thing resolved, we're going to have to take the approach, I guess, of the task force.
Sure.
Task force came up with a compromise. I don't think anybody's completely satisfied. Obviously, there's some bills in already to take care of things, and you people are going to submit amendments.
That's correct.
But I, and since Scott Gallen is sitting there at the podium, I'm personally very interested in seeing if there is not some kind of an approach we can take on that particular issue.
On the medical malpractice.
I like to refer to it as medical.
Could I ask this, Senator, is there a time then that you would wish to schedule a session of this committee specifically to address Chapter 752 and the medical malpractice thing as it fits into the picture?
Yes.
We'd certainly... You know, if you would schedule us, I suppose, you know, of course, as far ahead as we can, if we're going to talk about bringing any doctors down or what have you, I would like, you know, some advance notice. But if you will give us a date, we'll be more than happy to come down and discuss that as a topic.
Well, what I want to discuss is a topic either here or in my office.
Okay.
Or with any individual in this committee is... I mean, is there some solution to this problem, to this particular part of the problem, that hasn't been laid on the table yet? Can anybody come up with some other idea?
Mr. Chairman, if I may say something, on the first evening, I believe, of last week, in fact, about a week ago today, you asked about the same issue. The difficulty that my association is having is when it is you want us to discuss this issue with you before this committee. To put it very briefly, and we'll go into any kind of detail that you would like, the association tried to test the constitutionality of that chapter.
Okay, now wait a minute. I'm going to have...
And if I may finish, please. We also had a independent actuarial analysis done regarding that chapter on where we would be today if it had been instituted.
Okay, now look, you're going to have a chance to go into this thing completely. I mean, this isn't the time to do it. I'm simply saying to you that I would like to have you think about somebody came up with this idea. It may have been a bad idea, but at least it was an idea. And I invite and encourage your group, particularly, to see if this approach, whether it's the based on this or it's based on the Oregon Bar's approach to the problem, is not a solution. Isn't there something else out there? Is all I'm saying to you. And but on the particular issue of medical negligence and physicians' liability, yes, we're going to have a hearing on that one issue, and that will include a chance then to discuss Chapter 752 and why it didn't, why it hasn't worked. I mean, I know about the concern about the constitutionality, so you'll have a chance on that, come back on that. We're a little far off the track on Section 7 here.
What I was going to say about Section 7, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, was this, that I would say that I think we're in general agreement with the aim of this section. It is a position that we feel strongly about as a policy matter. I do have some questions with regards to some of the provisions in the draft, which of course, I unfortunately was not present during the interim committee's deliberations, and so I don't know why these were put in. And so I'll simply raise the questions I have, and perhaps you or staff or somebody can answer them. Number one is to why this should be a defense, if it is a good policy, why it should be a complete defense only to actions based on ordinary negligence. In other words, why shouldn't it be a defense also to actions such as trespass, actions such as strict liability, strict products liability, or what have you? If it's a good policy to have it as a defense to a lawsuit, it seems to me that it should cover the gamut.
Well, you mean, for example, if the police officer willfully shoots the fleeing suspect in the back, the suspect, of course, running from the scene of a burglary, which would be a felony, that then there would be immunity for a lawsuit against the police officer.
Well, if you, as a matter of policy, want to, you know, draw other parameters, of course, I think that you could do so. I think you'd find some argument on that.
Well, I guess.
And it may also be governed by your exception here, which we agree to under your 1983 actions. In fact, I don't practice in that area, but it seems to me I have read and seen where frequently the 1983 actions are those which are filed in just those types of cases.
Well, I guess the answer to your earlier inquiry, the task force felt that if there was going to be any change in this particular area, that it didn't want to go so far as to say that a willful injury was going to be immunized because the person who was injured happened to be involved in the commission of crime.
Well, I think there's a big difference, however, between willful injury and trespass and strict liability. And perhaps maybe my suggestion is that if that is the decision or the policy decision to be made, that we might further refine the the language there and, you know, say it doesn't apply to willful injuries.
All right. This is one of the areas, again, where no one was able to say how this was going to make a lick of difference in terms of insurance.
I can't tell you either, but I think it as a matter of policy, and as I said a few moments ago, I think there are a number of things as I've gone through this bill that you're looking at, which quite frankly are policy decisions, rather than decisions that are calculated to have an immediate effect on the reduction of insurance liability premiums. Secondly, as to why under subparagraph A you limited it to a Class A or a Class B felony, it seems to me that there are a number of categories of Class C felonies, whether in the burglary area, the trespass
stealing
area.
Stealing firewood.
Pardon?
Stealing firewood.
I remember that. Anyway, that perhaps you're being too severe again on a policy basis in limiting it to Class A or Class B felonies. But again, I don't know why that decision was made, why you excluded Class C felonies. Somebody suggested to me it may have had something to do with a driving while suspended situation, which may be a Class C felony, where perhaps a driver who's driving while suspended gets involved in an automobile accident with another party who's drunk. Would this preclude the person who's guilty of DWS from suing the drunk driver? I think that your condition in here that says that the felonious conduct under subparagraph B was a substantial factor contributing to the injury or death might handle that type of a situation, if that was your concern.
The guy who's out driving a car, I suppose, and runs into somebody, certainly, or gets run into, I suppose, is driving the car was a substantial factor in contributing to his injury.
Well, again, I think I would only ask, you know, you're sweeping a lot of Class C felonies, it seems to me, out of the picture where it might be justifiable to include them in this policy.
If there's a possibility that you could give us an example of a wrongful result in an Oregon court, because that would, you know, give us a little bit to go on as to why we should change the law, I'd appreciate it.
Well, I guess I don't like to answer a question with a question back, but obviously the interim task force felt that there was a policy reason for including this in there. And as I say, I think from our standpoint, we feel it is a good public policy as well. But I'll certainly do some checking, and I'll check in this area of Class C felonies as well. Although, as I say, I'm really at a loss to know why the interim committee decided to leave that category out.
It was just like all of the interim committee's work. It was a compromise, you see, and
okay.
There were a number of people who thought that based on a single case, yes, pardon?
I guess I think we ought to make these determinations about whether this committee feels like the section ought to be in or out, and whether there's validity to any of these policy changes that are recommended. Because I'm not sure we're in a position to second-guess they thought or didn't think or what they were basing it on. So I'd rather kind of use my time to talk with Kip or other committee members to say, you know, what's the purpose of 7 really in a sentence or two other than what I can read here directly that sort of exempts some of those
cases? I think the public feels strongly as a matter of public policy that an individual who is injured during the commission of a crime and principally during the commission of a felony ought not to be able to turn around and sue his or her victim. As simple as that. And I think if you polled the public about that, you'd find probably find them feeling almost unanimously.
That's a good enough reason for me. Have we done it here?
You've done it part way, yes.
Part way, yeah.
Yes. And the only questions I'm raising are, why did you stop, or why do we stop where we do? Why did the interim task force stop where it did? From what the chairman is saying, it was a matter of compromises. I'm not aware of what demanded the compromises. That's all I'm saying.
We're going to start them all over again if there are reasons to, so thank you.
Subparagraph 2requires that to establish the defense described in the section, the defendant must prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the person was engaged in conduct that would constitute a Class A or B felony. It seems to me a logically to follow that would be is that if in fact the person was convicted of the Class A or B felony or convicted of the felony, that that should be prima facie evidence allowing you to establish the defense, and you shouldn't have to require the defendant in that case to go once again and prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the what the individual did was commit the felony.
Record of conviction would be admissible, and that would take care of that element.
I think you would obviate any questions, Senator, in this if you simply said that.
There's no question in my mind. As a matter of evidence, that's exactly what would happen.
Well, 6 years ago, there was no question in my mind when I sponsored and supported the liquor liability legislation to codify the common law that that's exactly what we intended to do. Last year, the Supreme Court told me and all of my colleagues who were involved in that we intended to create a new cause of action, a strict liability cause of action. After listening to Mr. Vetri yesterday, and I talked to him in the hall afterwards, it occurred to me that as we go through this, we may have to make our intents a lot clearer than we think, even by additional language in the bills, if necessary.
Chairman.
That's all I have to say on 7.
One of the things I like about this provision is it doesn't have the kind of language in it that the statute does on crime victims, where it says if they were their conduct substantially contributed to their mm-hmm. injury and they were breaking the law, then they can't recover. I think that's brought about some real unfairness, and in one particular case I was involved in, I know it did, and it hurt the medical providers because this guy had a tremendous injury and what he did was illegal, but what happened to him was so much more than what he was doing. It was just overwhelming. But that's partly because we haven't funded that fund. But I would be willing to look at having more things than A and B felony. And maybe we could get some help from you in exchange on... I'm still smarting from the time we tried to index the admission to the penitentiary on theft, cost of living index, and somebody got up and said, if we pass this bill, we'll be telling the crooks they didn't get their money's worth.
I don't remember that.
I think you that said it.
What?
Any further questions of the witness? Okay, fine, thank you. Then now,
Sections 8 and 9, prejudgment interest, I'm going to let Mr. Richter for OADC and SEALS speak on that, and I guess you have other witnesses on that. I will not be testifying on that.
Okay. Well, let's, Peter Richter, you can come back up on Sections 8 and 9, prejudgment interest.
Thank you, Senator. As I read this section, it would require a judge to award prejudgment interest on any successful claim based on tortious conduct if the judge determines that the defendant had failed to meet a settlement demand lower than the amount awarded by the jury. I guess initially, I don't see where this particular section addresses the two concerns I think the tort reform package generally should address, and that is lowering insurance premiums and dealing with the, if you disagree with my characterization of the litigation explosion, the litigation costs, then I don't see how permitting additional recovery of money meets either of those two goals. Secondly, in reviewing this section, it presupposes that defendants are the only ones who refuse to settle cases. And that, to me, is unfair, and everybody who I've talked to and who's analyzed this couldn't understand what the basis was for that assumption. We spoke earlier about some empirical data. If there is any that says defendants are the only ones who refuse to settle cases, I'd like to see it. If this section were to have an additional provision that said if the plaintiff recovers less from a jury than the defendant offered, then the defendant would be entitled to attorney fees plus interest, then that would make this section equitable. Otherwise, it's just unfair. It doesn't take into account jury awards for future pain and suffering. It's difficult for me to understand why prejudgment, that is, before a jury determines what the amount of the actual injury is in a dollar sense, for that pain, suffering, loss of income that the injured party is going to sustain in the future, why interest on that amount should be awarded from the time the claim is filed, which, as at least we lawyers know, it's about two